A very busy Tuesday show, July 16th, 2024, right here for you on Connecticut Today. I open the show with thoughts on a report the Democrats will not follow their usual procedures in nominating President Joe Biden for another term. GOP State Senate member Jeff Gordon talked about growing calls for more penalties aimed at those who take part in those so-called illegal street takeovers around Connecticut. Veteran intelligence analyst and counterterrorism specialist Brian Boyd joined the show. He broke down the security failures during Saturday's attempted assassination of former President Trump in Pennsylvania. And finally, Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio returned for her weekly update.
You know, for all the talk about how one party over the other in this state and the big cities all across the country and in D.C., for all the talk about how the Democrats and progressives talk about how they are the bastion of liberty. We're not like those bad Republicans who were going to do this, and the guy that may get reelected again is Adolf Hitler and Pol Pot and Karl Marx and Joseph Stalin and Joseph Mengele and all this. You know, for all the hot air and the claptrap we get from the Democratic Party out there, it's amazing how they subvert the will of the people. What am I talking about? Well, think about it. And there's a new update here. I'm going to get to this. And I'd love to hear, honestly, from you anti-Trump people who, you know, if you have not one single flicker of a moment that you would say, hey, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, I'd love to hear from you. Because if you say, well, I'm a card-carrying Democrat, well, what do you think of when your party stifles dissent? Now, we say, well, what are you talking about, Paul? Well, you know, and how your party sets it up here. Now, one of the reasons that Joe Biden is likely intransigent, people are saying, about getting out this time is because he felt that he was screwed in 2016 when they said, Joe, we know you've been a good soldier. We know you stood behind Barack Obama for 8 years, but please step aside because, of course, it's Hillary's turn. How'd that work out? Right? How did that work out? What about in 2020? When, you know, when Bernie said, well, 2016, too, but 2016 and 2020, yeah, when they put the fix in with those superdelegates and the way the primaries were planned to keep Bernie Sanders out. Well, we can't have Bernie. Yeah, but a lot of people like him. Yeah, but, you know, he's a bit on the socialist side, which is fine. So, you know, in a way, I understand where the anger is coming from. From Joe Biden, they shoved him aside in 2016 because it was Hillary's turn, and now they're trying to shove him aside because, hey, he's getting old out there. But man, they did the same thing to Bernie Sanders. Now Bernie is Bernie, and he still sounds relatively with it in his early 80s. And look, the people of Vermont vote for him; that's fine. But you know, you have two recent examples here of the Democratic Party basically anointing somebody and saying, screw what the people think. Now, I know what you're going to say. Well, the president did win all those votes. And Bernie, you know, Hillary did better than Biden. I mean, come on. If you don't think after the whole Hillary Biden thing in 2016, and if you don't think, you know, the fix is in here after two times with Bernie, and now this, what am I driving at? Well, now this, and again, you can talk all you want about the Republicans, and that's fine. God bless you. You hate Trump. You despise Trump. You can now hate J.D. Vance, whatever. Look what he said about Trump. That's fine. Go ahead and do that. That's the base of American politics. But my God, don't talk about the Republican Party as being, you know, some denier of the right of the people when it's the Democrats who basically for the past two or three election cycles have literally, now I know what you're going to say, there were votes, yeah, but when you can only vote for certain people, that's fixed. And guess what? The fix is in again. Axios, which is a center-left-leaning news organization out of D.C., they have a big story today. It was posted about 10 hours ago. I think Lisa may have talked about this on her show today because we were texting back and forth about this. You Democrats, how about this? Scoop. how the DNC plans to run out the clock for Joe Biden. When you have members, you Democrats out there, if you're not teed off about this, there's something going on. There really is. There's something going on with you. First, it was Hillary over Joe Biden, which is why he's so intransigent. And then they put the screws to Bernie Sanders. Well, we can't nominate a socialist. Well, I don't think you should have either. But you have to admit your party screws people if they don't like him. At least the Republicans, with an incumbent former president who basically everybody knew was going to be the nominee, at least you had a boisterous, sometimes laughable, sometimes really good primary process, and Donald Trump won. But what is this about, well, you can challenge Joe Biden? Well, you know, he had challenges. Come on, stop. That Congressman Dean Phillips, I think his name is, in Minnesota. Good for him for getting it. Marianne Williamson, stop. She's not going to. It's to push her books. We all know that. But how about this? You talk about the fix being in at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You hypocrites. Now, look, you can hate Trump. That's fine. But your party ain't nothing better. And I don't want to hear how they both stink and this and that. Well, a lot of times they do stink. But you know what? At least the Republicans are up front with what they're doing. The Democrats right now. And by the way, I've got some cuts last night from Joe Biden. You know, this whole thing with Trump, as sad as it is, this bought Joe Biden some time. And everybody's saying it because if that psycho doesn't almost take out Trump Saturday in Bethlehem, PA there. Outside of not Bethlehem, I forgot the name of the town, but outside of Pittsburgh there, the meme and the big buzz here is still Biden's got to go, especially after that sit down last night with Lester Holt from NBC. Are you kidding? He was crankier than all get out. I've got some of that for you coming up. But how about this? For you people who say, well, the Democrats, yeah, we do it right. The Democratic National Committee is quietly steaming ahead with plans to technically nominate President Biden weeks before the party's convention next month. They don't want Joe anywhere near the convention where people may revolt. How dare they do that with the Democratic Party when the fix is in? It's the latest effort by Biden's team to stamp out a Democratic rebellion that's been pushing for the president to step aside. Once Joe Biden gets the votes from a majority of the nearly 4,000 delegates, it'll become exceedingly difficult to remove him from atop the Democratic presidential ticket. So you Democrats out there, you know what's going on here? They're going to do this on basically a big Zoom call. Not like the Republicans did it last night and yesterday. We had some live dip-ins here. You heard the states going around and saying, ba-ba, and the state of the Connecticut, the home of high taxes, you know, lousy roads and voter confusion and ballot boxes that are ripe for fraud. We nominate, ba-ba, ba-ba. You know, no, they're not going to do that. The DNC's current plan is to train state party chairs. Nancy DiNardo, you're going to have to go to school next week, Nancy. The DNC's current plan is to train state party chairs next week on how to conduct the electronic voting in a secure way. Ha ha! What are they hiding from? The window for voting is likely to open on July 29th and conclude by August the 5th. You understand what they're doing here, folks? They know they've got a, I don't want to say senile, but I'll play you some of the cuts later. And you make your decision here. They're hiding the process. This is the United States of America, and the party in power is doing things on the backhand here, in the closet. If the working plan for a virtual roll call, in other words, not with anybody on site, If the working plan for a virtual roll call holds, Joe Biden just has to outlast his party's critics for about two more weeks. What happened to the will of the people? What happened to the will of Congress? I thought only the Republicans were against that. Now, Joe Biden, and you know, the soundbite you're getting from him now, well, you know, he whispers, well, they voted for me. Yeah, and a rigged system. Jamie Harrison, the chair of the DNC, told Axios, we look forward to nominating Joe Biden through a virtual roll call and celebrating with fanfare together in Chicago in August along the 99% of delegates who were supporting the Biden-Harris ticket. So you see what Jamie Harrison here and the Democrats are doing. And boy, you card-carrying Democrats, are you all right with this? Or do you feel that, hey, there should be another choice here? Because I guess you're considered the peons, the minions, like the new movie out there. Go watch that movie, Despicable Me 4. Very funny. Look up there and the little guy's going, that's you. You saps. I'm not calling you a sap, but that's what the DNC is doing. Axios says some delegates are concerned the DNC is trying to jam them by moving up the voter deadline. Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, a Biden delegate from Maryland, is writing to her fellow delegates behind the scenes. People at the Biden campaign, the DRs, and the DNC are working to put in the fix. Put simply, she wrote, they're trying to shut down the process earlier. We can't allow it. I'm asking you to ask the DNC to stop pushing for an early vote. Chris Dempsey, longtime Democratic activist in Massachusetts, says there's an information vacuum. He says the delegates we talked to have heard very little from the state parties or the DNC. I wonder if Nancy DiNardo, the Democratic state chairman here in Connecticut, if she's on board with this. The DNC's stated reason for front-running the nomination is an August 7th deadline for ballot access in Ohio. Now, Ohio has moved that. That's not relevant. It's now September the 1st. Here's the bottom line. You people who laugh at Trump, who laugh at J.D. Vance, who laugh at the Republicans and say, well, I'm a proud Democrat. Well, guess what? The Democratic Party is screwing you. Nice and nice. You're getting the screw job from the Democratic Party. They hey, we got to get this done quick before they want to get rid of senile Joe. It is. The hypocrisy here is just oozing. And what's impacting a lot of folks is fear when a lot of people just innocently out, you know, running errands, going to the store, going to visit people, going out on the weekends, date night, family night, whatever, and they get caught up in these street takeovers. In fact, I just did a quick Google search and you see all the headlines here. Street takeover caused mayhem in New Haven. Video captures apparent street takeover in New Haven. State police responding to a street takeover in Bethany. It goes on occasionally, too. In Bridgeport, the folks in Waterbury are trying to crack down on this. And we're only about one-third of the way through the summer. At least two more months to go in the warm weather here. So what can the General Assembly do, and what permission do these cities and towns have to do? Should we get the imprimatur from the folks in Hartford to make the laws stronger, maybe strengthen what can be done as far as, you know, confiscating these illegal, at least on the road, ATVs and mini bikes and destroying them? And joining us right now to talk about that is Republican State Senate member Dr. Jeff Gordon, who among his committee assignments is a member of the Public Safety Committee. Jeff, it's Paul here. Good to have you back on the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. Great to be back. I hope you're doing fine.
I'm doing good, Jeff. Thanks. And boy, I got to tell you, sure as you can set your watch by when the summer months come out and, you know, you start to see these street takeovers and, you know, you get video of this stuff, Jeff. It's paraded all over social media. People saying they fear for their lives when they get caught up in this stuff. Are we doing enough? Are you seeing, Jeff, personally in Hartford, enough being done here? I know there was a move to crack down a little more on this, but where do we stand as far as what the states can do and what, you know, towns are allowed to do here?
Well, it's certainly very concerning given what's happening, and we still have a good amount of the summer to go through. I remember in Tallinn, one of the towns I represent, what went on last year with a massive street takeover. The state really needs to do more. I'm not blaming law enforcement. We need to make certain as state lawmakers, we let law enforcement use their training and give them resources to proactively go after these people. And then certainly we need more enforcement. I was disappointed this year that the legislature didn't do more. I supported some bills and really tried to see if we could get some bills pushed through that really tighten and make more strict the penalties for these types of criminal acts, but also including let towns create ordinances that, you know, cars, ATVs, motorcycles that are purposely used for these types of street takeovers can be confiscated. Taking away people's licenses is when they purposely commit these types of crimes. There's more that we should be doing, and I really hope that the upcoming legislative session in January, we renew the effort to do more. I would love to have a special session just focused on this, and let's make the laws better, but unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. But there is indeed more we should do, and my Republican colleagues and I are really pushing on this.
So Jeff, I guess what you're saying here, and I guess a lot of people don't understand, you know, local police, I guess, can make some arrests, but as far as further penalties, as you say, confiscation, suspension of licenses and registration, that has to be handled by on the state level, correct, through the DMV?
It does. If we want to deal with taking away people's licenses who commit these crimes, enabling towns or even the state to confiscate these vehicles that are used to commit these types of crimes and putting the public in severe and serious jeopardy for their safety, that has to be through enabling law. And there was an effort this year, a Senate bill and a House bill. It just didn't seem to make it all the way through the finishing line in a 3-month short session, but there was quite a push. I was happy to be part of that in a bipartisan way. And we just need to make another push this upcoming legislative session to get this done. And then that will really put more teeth into enforcement. And we really need strong enforcement. And that means we need stricter laws.
35th District Republican State Senate member Dr. Jeff Gordon is the guest. We're talking about these street takeovers. Jeff, let's do a two-parter here. First of all, what were some of the, if you can cite one or two, some of the objections you may have heard on this bill? Was there any pushback here? Were there some legislative members saying, you know, this is a little too draconian, a little too harsh, maybe for people that just get caught up in the excitement of this? Did you hear that or anything like it?
I didn't really hear that much from a lot of my legislative colleagues. You know, there was a bill that actually did pass the House unanimously. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, the Senate majority party leadership didn't seem to want to push the bill. So it just never made it through the Senate. But, you know, I haven't been hearing from my fellow legislators to say, oh, this is bad, that we need to have stricter laws and, you know, help law enforcement go after these people to keep the public safe. I've heard from some members of the public raising concerns with the police, you know, tag innocent bystanders. But the police officers I've been speaking with, and I speak with a lot of police officers in my part of the state, they're not going after innocent bystanders. They're going after the people who are very clearly committing these crimes, driving their cars and motorcycles, you know, in this dangerous way. The ringleaders, you know, who are starting these events and encouraging people to participate in events. That's who they're going after. They're not going to go after someone who just might be on a sidewalk watching and not otherwise involved. But we really need to get to the crux of it. And a lot of it is proactive policing and really having laws that really are meaningful and really take a bite out of this. And law enforcement people do want that. And I've heard that from a lot of police officers.
Yeah. And Jeff, I did notice, too, a lot of this stuff, and you probably heard this in testimony, a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times, sometimes I'm astounded to read stories from the publications here to my listeners that these things are organized by, like, out-of-state people, like New Jersey, southern Massachusetts. I mean, listen, Jeff, as great of a state as we have here, you got to drive from New Jersey to do this in Connecticut? With all due respect, it's like, is it that boring in North Jersey? I don't know, but a lot of this stuff is out-of-state people, isn't it?
Oh, it is, and that's part of the problem. They're coming in, they're using the highways as the entryway, and then a lot of this is, you know, they're getting off of exits and, you know, organizing these things. If you look where a lot of the street takeovers have been taking place, it's very convenient for them to hop on a highway, you know, then create the event and then hop back on the highway and then just leave. And so, yes, there are out-of-state people, and there's in-state people, but it is a problem, just not in Connecticut, unfortunately, but for whatever reason, Connecticut seems to be a popular place for it. Maybe it's because it's easy off the highway to get to some of these cities and towns. We're not a big state to travel around.
Yeah. Finally, Jeff, if this stuff is revived, and I hope, as you say, it will be in the long session coming up, what should be issue one here? To quote the great John McLaughlin, the late John McLaughlin, what should be issue one? In other words, there's probably things that everybody wants in a bill like this, but what, in your mind, Jeff, should be the primary action or ability given out in a bill like this to slow things down? What would you say is a non-starter for a bill if this is not in the bill? What would that be?
Two major things. One is giving the resources and letting the police do what they're trained to do to proactively go after these people and enforce the laws. And number two, have stricter laws that for when criminals commit these types of crimes and jeopardize the public, there's a meaningful impact, a consequence. And our laws don't do that now. So we have to have both of those. And if we don't, then we're really limiting what we can do. And I believe the legislation this year really tried to get at that. I would love to have funding to help the towns and cities, but regardless of funding for it, we really need to do those two major things. We can do it. There's a lot of agreement on it. We just need to actually get it done, and I hope we can, and I know my colleagues and I are working and pushing this issue.
All right. 35th District State Senator Dr. Jeff Gordon has been the guest. Jeff, good to hear from you. Thanks, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this down the road. Appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Have a good rest of the day.
You too, sir. Dr. Jeff Gordon, State Senate member, Republican side, District 35, represents a rather suburban part of the state. Let's welcome back a gentleman that we haven't had on for a while. We spoke to this man and got his input several times at the outset of the Ukraine-Russia war and other hot spots popping up. He's a 30-year-plus professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, law enforcement professional. He's a former Green Beret, part of the leadership team of the Joint Special Ops Command, which, of course, oversees SEAL Team 6 and Special Forces and Delta Force. He also served in the Departments of Defense, Justice, and the Treasury, regularly appears nationwide on TV and radio for his expertise. Welcoming back Brian Boyd to the program here in Connecticut. Hey, Brian, it's Paul in Connecticut here. How are you?
It's good to hear your voice. Sorry, we have to do it on such a strange occasion, but that's the way the world turns.
Yeah. So, Brian, I don't know if you were watching this thing live. I mean, it was a nice day, and millions of people probably weren't. I found out about it when my phone started to blow up. I was at a nice summer barbecue. And so what are your thoughts here? You probably have seen the video and watched it several dozen times, reading now about what the Secret Service did and didn't do and how this joker was left unguarded on top of a building. So, Brian, take us through, with your background, what you see here.
Well, this is my analysis of it. I was actually watching it live and sitting down in front of the big screen TV and having dinner.
Wow.
And when I saw it, I knew, recognized right away it was gunshots. And when I saw him grab his ear, I knew he probably got hit. And then I saw him go down. I wasn't sure whether or not he got clipped low on his body, but the way he went down, I knew he was going down behind that barricade. Now, that barricade, a lot of people don't know it, that's a bulletproof barricade covered with bunting to disguise it. But that's the only bulletproof thing. There's no bulletproof podium, mm-hmm. which is a mistake. And there was no glass. And they, I guess he's got so used to doing so many open-air venues, and nobody's ever seen him have any serious threats, because rallies with the Trump people are always clean. They pick up their picnic supplies. They never leave trash. And they're always a fest. In my opinion, this is an issue where the Secret Service detail, unlike saying it was a security breach, this is an absolute security failure.
Mm.
If you envision yourself as a civilian standing on the stage hours before and surveying it as if you were doing in advance, you'd look around and say, well, we need to put something on that rooftop because that's within the short range of a rifle. And historically, we've lost presence from short-range rifles and close-up pistols. That's the way it's always been. And so, to me, this was a security failure. They failed to do it. And I heard the Secret Service say early on it was outside their perimeter. I said, that's outside their perimeter, but it's not outside a target range.
Yeah.
It was short-range rifles. So, and then I heard that they're trying to blame the local police. And I said, I answered this on a Fox radio TV station this morning.
Mm-hmm.
You can't blame the cops because the cops are under the control of the Secret Service. The agent on the scene, the advance team, whoever's in charge of that entire detail for that particular day is totally responsible, as is the director, for anything in the way of mistakes because everybody reports to them. And then the third thing I saw is the communication breakdown. If you understand the way cops work, state, city, local, and federal,
mm-hmm.
they don't have a common communication chain. They're not even, the military does, because we learned that the hard way with the raid in Tehran, the Delta and SEAL Team 6. But they didn't have communication comms. But this, when the cops saw it, if he did holler a mayday or shoot on the roof, it probably went to his local dispatcher, and that loss of time, not getting to the earpieces of the Secret Service agents on stage, prevented them from taking any immediate action. So that lack of rehearsal, that's lack of preparedness. Boy Scouts are be prepared. They were not prepared for this thing, and they failed miserably. All of my friends from the Secret Service and my background working with DEA and JSOC, we all gave them an F on basic security principles, security 101.
Brian, let's talk about the shooter, where he was, I guess the type of rifle they're talking about here, and the shot. Now, apparently, this kid, at least that we know of, they're not saying whether there's a political trail or not, so they're looking into that, but apparently he was apparently a decent shot. He was on his high school rifle team. I've had relatives who used to be on those teams here in the East when we still had those in the Northeast. Brian, from that distance, with what he was using, how difficult of a shot is that or not?
Well, any teenager, now this kid's 20, he's just out of his teens.
Yeah.
That is a very short, basic shot for a basic trainee in the United States Army. It's a very close shot. It's done with iron sights. You don't need a scope to do it. It's only 140 yards. It's close enough to do, and any kid could have done that. My theory, and I hear all these conspiracy theories about his political leanings, and if I understand he was being bullied, I'm guessing, much like this guy that blew up the RV in Nashville mm-hmm. 7 years ago that I testified on,
yeah.
I think he was trying to make a statement that he was a brave guy. I don't think he had any political leanings. He had no military training. And my understanding is he was disqualified from the rifle team because he was not a good shot. That's what I heard the first time. I'm not sure if it's changed with what you're saying. But I just believe that this kid was trying to do something to make a name for himself. That's my theory, because I can't see any linkages to any left-wing groups, right-wing groups, and that sort of thing so far. But it's going to take a while for the investigation to ferret it out.
Now,
I suspect that's part of it.
Yeah, and Brian, this building that he was on, ironically, was used, the inside of it, for the law enforcement staging here. But we're getting this
right.
this weird story of how people apparently saw somebody up there. They got somebody's attention. And now what happened? Some cops went over there with a ladder, and they stuck their head up above the edge there, and they saw him, but they couldn't get a shot off. What's up with that?
Well, from the way I was understanding the sequence, one of the leaders, it wasn't an ordinary policeman, they said a police leader, which means it must have been a senior sergeant or something, when he got his hands to the edge of the roof and peeked over the top, that's when Crooks turned around and aimed the rifle at him, and the cop ducked back down. Now, if you understand what's going on, and this is where my law enforcement friends are concerned, why didn't that guy throw himself into the fire? He should have gone into the situation. Anybody with a rifle on a roof is an immediate threat to the president. And this is where the cop didn't take his action like he normally did. He ducked down. Well, if he did, think about it from a sequence of events. If he sees this happening, he ducks down. Did he contact, did he do a mayday call? Did he say a sniper on the roof? Anything. And if he did, the time lapse from the comms, from what I understand of internal communications of these agencies, would have been a long lapse of many seconds before it would have gone through the local comm center, wherever that cop's radio connects, to wherever that connects to the other people, because you've got sheriff, state, local, city, this convoluted group of people, before it would have gotten to the earpieces of the Secret Service agents on stage who were on a different network from the cops. So that's a massive failure. Again, that's a failure of security principles. My career, from you're talking to me over the years, I've always been picked up as an intelligence chief for agencies that get recreated or invented because of intelligence failures. And that's what happens. Every time you have a major intelligence failure, they go back and they change the system. When Delta had the failed raid, they created JSOC. When the CIA messed up, the DEA got created. These agencies, when they have mistakes, that's how they create these things. And it's always afterwards. So, you know, I think there's going to be a major shakeup. There has to be a major shakeup. One of the other things, Paul, that I find to be difficult, my best friend is a Secret Service retiree like me.
Okay.
And we realized that when the Secret Service was invented in the Treasury Department, their only legal authority for arrest is for counterfeiting. They got borrowed because they had guns by the president. So they have no investigative authority. That's why they turn all the evidence over to the FBI, which convolutes the situation. And they probably, and then they put them under the Homeland Security, which created a bureaucratic oversight nightmare. Doesn't make it any better. And you got bureaucrats running them. So I think they probably ought to pull the Secret Service out, assign it to the office of the president as an executive group, and allow them to provide presidential support. Obviously, we saw where the Biden administration pulled presidential support from Kennedy, which I think is insane and obviously stupid.
Yeah.
You know, they finally going to give it back to him. But, you know, why do we have to wait till somebody gets shot or shot at before we kind of make these improvements? But I think that would be one of the things they could do to make the system work better, and then they could be better off.
Yeah.
The other thing, if you don't mind my being...
No, sure. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
This DEI thing that the Secret Service director did a speech on that day, she spoke... And she was talking about how she wants to make the Secret Service DEI and 30% female. Well, you saw three female agents trying to surround a 6'3", 243-pound man. And from a sniper's point of view, that's a sniper's dream because that one lady only covered the lower half of him, his whole upper torso, and his head was exposed. And the whole world saw that on national TV. So it's not a practical decision. I don't care how people feel about diversity. You have to have tall people protect the tall client.
Yeah. Mr. Trump's a big guy. He's not. And Brian, I was wondering about that. You know, other presidents have been slightly smaller and shorter, but I'm watching that like you did several times. I'm going, you know, part of the reason Trump wanted to get up there and hold the fist in the air, it's fine. But I'm saying to myself, boy, he's still, as they were getting him into that SUV, Brian, I'm saying he's still exposed.
Yeah, he was still exposed on the stage when he stood up looking for his shoes, too. And that's the thing that I saw. And I, you know, plus, they didn't rehearse the emergency procedures that are normally done when this. They didn't have easy access to the automobile. They had this narrow stairway, and the agents had to jump off the stage and were crowded, and they're bumping into each other. And the agent who is trying to protect them from the direction of the bullet is the short female who's 5-something, and Trump's 6'3". So this whole thing is a series of, Laurel and Hardy mistakes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's going to have to have a major shakeup. And at my age, I've seen all these things in life, and I think the younger generation have forgotten what's called lessons learned. You probably know. You're probably over 40.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen the southern side of 40 in years, Brian. Great stuff, folks. Brian's website, if you want to check it out, Boyd, B-O-Y-D, BoydIntelligence.com. Brian, good to chat with you. I'm sure we'll talk again down the line, Brian Boyd. Take care, Brian. Be good, and we'll talk down the road.
My pleasure. Your weather's the same as mine down here, only it's 10 degrees hotter.
Yeah. All right, Brian, stay cool, buddy. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Take care, Paul. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Brian Boyd there. There you go, folks. Ex-Special Ops, Green Beret, SEAL Team 6, Delta Force. He knows from whence he speaks. Back with us this week, Megan Portfolio. She, herself, and her exclusive staff put together the Hartford Portfolio blog from the Yankee Institute. Ms. Portfolio, how are you this week?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. So you and your entire staff, everything is good? All your writers, all your research people, your legal department, everything's good?
All of my friends.
Well, what might be on your mind this merry week, Megan? I have an inkling of what you're going to talk about, and I have a theory about that, but lay it on us.
Oh, no, which one? Because I wasn't sure what you wanted to talk about, because I either wanted to talk about the incestuous relationship between big labor and our politicians.
Yeah.
But then we also have, like, this executive order that
came out. And I have a theory about the executive order, but go ahead and lay it on my listeners here. The governor signing an executive order to do what exactly?
Well, I call it the woke office, but the official title is the Office to Promote Equity and Inclusion within Connecticut State Government. That's a mouthful.
Yeah. So, and what does what does all that mean?
I guess we must have some issues within the state government that we need to have like a six-figure salary added to the payroll to make sure everything's all equitable and there's no racism and there's diversity and there's inclusion. I was starting to go blind when I was reading the press release because I think they used the word equity about 3,000 times. Like, I still don't understand what that means.
I wonder, Megan, now, when you had pointed that out to me, and I kind of missed that, then I went to the Capitol Report, and then I got the governor's press release here. I wonder if this has anything to do, and far be it from me to be a conspiracy person, but things happen for a reason. You had the accusations, right, from a past state health commissioner, and we had accusations from the governor's former budget head, did we not, about hostile work environments and being racially insensitive? Am I wrong here or what?
No, that happened, and I haven't written about it yet, and so I'm scooping myself here. The DOT actually just did a survey internally about diversity and tapping the workers to see, like, are we diverse? Do we need more training? Do we need more DEI? They have, like, they keep changing the acronym for it. I'm using the old one, but it's something new now. And I'm about to write on it because it seemed like half the workers were like, can you just leave me alone? I just want to, like, come to work and do my job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't need any more diversity training. Like, I just want to go to work, get paid, get my pension, and call it a day. And then the other half were like, yes, we need more training. We need more diversity. So I think some of it may have to do with some internal surveys that they've been conducting.
And you and I, Megan,
my hands on the DOT one, so I'm not sure if the other agencies have done the same.
Okay, I'd be interested to read what you write on this. But, Megan, you and I both know, because we've been following this long enough, listen, there may be some diversity issues because think about it. Now, again, there are plenty of minority state workers, but think about over the years how state workers, not all of them, let's be fair here, but a lot of this is kind of a sort of nepotism here. And I work for the state, right? Well, we have a couple of positions. Like, I wonder if that's what they're fighting. That I know people who have gotten state jobs and, you know, it's a lot. Oh, you're working for the state. Well, yeah, because so-and-so told me, or I got the high sign on this position. So it wouldn't surprise me, Megan, if that's really needed, because you and I both know the state's hiring process is not exactly clear and open.
No, it's not clear and open, and it's also kind of a pain in the butt. I mean, it's not like in the private sector where you go on your interview, maybe have another one, depending on the position, another, you know, two or three interviews. It's the state, as with everything, drags the process out so long. So, because I know people personally that, you know, they've applied for state jobs and then, you know, they don't hear anything for months on end. And it's like, well, I can't just sit here not having a job, and they move on and end up getting something in the private sector. So, I mean, they have issues with that. I'm really excited for this to get started. I'm not happy that I have to pay for it. I mean, I guess right now they're using they're already using unspent, like, appropriated funds. But, you know, next time around, they're going to be asking for more money for it. But I can't wait to FOIA all of this stuff. I can't wait to see what this training involves.
Yeah. And I wonder whether I wonder if this, and the guest is Megan Portfolio from the Yankee Institute. I wonder what the goal is here, Megan, because a lot of times it's one of two things, basically. It's a corporation or a governmental entity says, we really don't have a diverse enough workforce. We have to do this. Or they fake it. And they say, well, listen, we're not going to change anything, but let's do this diversity training because it'll make us feel good. I mean, I don't know how Governor Lamont, you know, acquiesces to that, but it's going to be interesting either way that shakes out.
Yeah, and I think that they're going outside of just, you know, HR for HR purposes. There was one bullet point that said they need to integrate equity into the budget process and assess the impact of budget decisions. So, I mean, that's super vague, and God only knows what that means and what woke stuff, you know, they're going to be budgeting for.
Yeah, and
you know, in all in the name of equity.
Yeah, and I wonder again if this is to quell any pressure, the kind of pressure, Megan, you and I see from, you know, the left end of the party, the Gary Winfields, the Martin Looney's, the other Christine Palms, those people who, you know, they had their every right to kind of shake the trees at the end of the budget process we saw a few weeks back, saying, hey, the governor, you know, his mode, his ideas on budgeting, simply kind of say, talk to the hand, you know, when it comes up to a lot of the stuff they want to get money for.
Yeah, that's true. That could be it. It's the whole thing was so vague, and I take a week off and I swear though everything went crazier than it was before I left. But I did not see this one coming. I have not heard any chatter about it. So it just kind of came out of nowhere, but it's going to be really interesting and watching it unfold. I can't wait to get my hands on the job posting. That'll be another good blog post because it's another six-figure job.
Yeah, why not? And finally, you said you wanted to talk a bit about the stuff that you constantly look at, which includes the, as you like to say it, your word, the incestuous relationship between labor and the state. So what do you have on that?
Yes, the Connecticut AFL-CIO held their annual convention at the end of June, and that's where they endorsed candidates past resolution. They endorsed 88 candidates. Almost half of them were union members. So we have union members running for office, and they were very open on social media. I put the story together basically through Twitter. I mean, they're ready to get in office, and they're ready to dismantle our fiscal guardrails.
Oh, yeah.
They're ready to put – and I'm not saying everything the unions want is bad. A lot of it is very good for the workers. Job site protection, that's good for workers. Fair wages is good for workers. But they step out of line and they get involved in other things that really aren't beneficial to the taxpayer. Like one of the things that they were pushing for last year was a minimum salary for teachers, which is great, but you can't just have a state minimum salary for teachers because, you know, towns and cities have to figure that into their budgets, and they're already strapped, and we're already seeing property increases. You know, they wanted that taxpayers to pay for striking workers. So, you know, we get these people in office, and these are the kinds of things that we're going to see. And they were very vocal about if the politicians don't do what we tell them to do, we're going to hold them to the fire. And they're actually forcing all the locals to allocate resources to campaign for pro-labor candidates. Like, they're 1% of every local has to provide, you know, boots on the ground, canvassing, phone calls. I mean, that really puts a lot of candidates at a disadvantage because, you know, they're getting all of this free labor from big labor.
Sure.
And other candidates. You know, I years ago, I did campaigning, and it's tough to get, you know, anyone just to make phone calls, never mind canvassing.
Me too. I did it on a couple of campaigns years ago. Yeah, I just wanted to feel like what boot camp was for 6 months, and believe me, I went through it. Listen, Megan, also on this whole scenario, right, you know, listen, I tell people, I know, you know, people of our ilk politically, listen, I know you don't like Governor Lamond for his attitudes that may differ with yours on, you know, guns and abortion and things like that. But, Megan, I'm warning my listeners, and I think you'd agree with this. If now they're shaking the trees for a third Lamond term. So whenever it becomes Governor Susan Bisewitz, which you and I both know is likely to happen, whenever that comes, Megan, I'm telling people there is going to be an orgasm of spending in this state, a lot like you've never seen. And really, and I know people don't like when I say this, thank God for Ned Lamont there, because he's pretty locked at the hip with the Republicans as far as the budget in this state. But after he's gone, look out. Look out.
Yeah, I mean, I got to give credit where credit's due. Governor Lamont has been great with the fiscal guardrails. Comptroller Sean Scanlon, he's also been committed to the guardrails. But, I mean, one of the candidates she's running against, she's primarying Doug McCrory out in the Hartford area, Shelley Davis. She's a union boss.
Yeah.
And she flat out said, you know, we want to get rid of these guardrails. We need to increase spending. You know, we need to level the playing field for workers at the bargaining table. I mean, she's flat out saying, you know, I want to be in office so I can do gimmies for the unions. And I want to increase spending, and then we're going to be back to where we were in the 90s, where we had to have an income tax. And the whole reason why we have these guardrails, because it was a, you know, I want to say it's a concession, but, you know, they're like, we're hitting you with this income tax. And then one of the terms was, well, you know, we need to start having some fiscal guardrails. You can't just keep spending, because this is why we're in this position. This is why we have unfunded liabilities. And, you know, all the taxes that we pay into the system, you know, mm-hmm. we're paying down debt that has occurred for decades, and they want to increase spending again. We want to get back to that. Like, we finally are in somewhat stable for Connecticut, you know,
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Stable situation. You want to go backwards? You want to go back to the 90s where we remember, like, those budget, you know, they didn't even let Dan Malloy into the room when they were trying to pass the budget. I'm like, I don't know about you. I don't want to be spending my summer watching these knuckleheads trying to, like, put a budget together because there's no money.
Yeah. What was that phrase, as we close here, Megan? What was that phrase, Ben Barnes? Now, Ben Barnes, God bless him, he always had that deer in the headlight look through those glasses. What did he say? Remember in the Malloy years, Ben Barnes used to say, we're in a constant state of, like, fiscal emergency. I'm not sure what it was, but, yeah, let's go back to those days. That makes complete sense, right, doesn't it?
I wasn't in the state at that time. I was up in the People's Republic of Boston, which had its own problems. But, you know, we don't want to be back in that situation. Yeah. If we get back in that situation, expect everything to go off.
Yeah.
Expect all our taxes to go up, state and local. And you know what? Maybe they'll have to start regionalizing. We'll have regional taxes like they do in New York.
Excellent.
You know, the money has to come from somewhere.
You were in Boston, huh? My old college town. I love that city.
Oh my God, it was so fun.
Oh, my
but
God.
Most of politics up there. It was tough up there.
Megan Portfolio, the Hartford Portfolio blogger at the Yankee Institute. Megan, thank you, and we'll talk next week.
Okay, have a good week.
All right, you too, Meg. Thanks.